You're listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast, and every week I bring you conversations with technologists who spent time on call. This week I speak to Dan Bentley. Dan Bentley is a software engineer who's currently fixing microservice development as CEO of Tilt, and that's tilt.dev. Before that, he was at Google for 11 years, and then at Twitter. He was working on tools for devs and tools for non-developers. He's open for the who, and has checks from Donald Knuth. Okay, good enough. He's a really great conversation, and I'm very glad that I got to have it. I met Dan maybe about a couple years ago at Gotham Go and thought that he had a really cool product. After doing that conversation, you know, we kind of talked about things here and there, and I was looking for someone to talk to about on call, and he's like, well, look, I wasn't necessarily traditional on call, but I got a story about some stuff I broke, and it sounds like a nightmare. And I said, you know what, Dan, I think that works. So Dan's on this week, and if you want to be on the podcast, let me tell you, it's not very, very difficult for you to be on. In the future, you can just go ahead and send me a Twitter DM at OnCallNightmare. You can send me a message at JDestro, or even easier, just send an email to OnCallNightmares@gmail.com. So that's really it. I want to also say I've been using a service for the last few months called PodcastTranscribe.com. They've been really great. They are a nonprofit. They just ask for a $5 donation. I've been giving them some cash here and there to make sure that all these episodes have been transcribed. Think you should check it out if you also do a podcast. Make sure you have transcriptions for your podcast so that people who are hard of hearing can get an opportunity to hear what's going on, or read what's going on, I should say. Pardon me. So anyhow, I'd like to get into the podcast. Let's go ahead and talk to Dan of Tilt and see what he's got going on. You're listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast, and every week I bring you conversations with technologists that have spent time on call or have been part of really big, complex systems that they may have been part of the on-call process. And either way, I've got someone today that I think is doing some really interesting stuff. His name is Dan Bentley. He's from a company called Tilt and Windmill. They're building lots of developer products so that you can do some really awesome stuff, especially around Kubernetes and Go. I've seen some of it before in the past. I'll let Dan talk about it as we go on. But Dan's done things like work for Google, work for Twitter, and he's open for the who. So I got to hear more about that. So Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here.
No problem. You know, I like to bring on people that I've had like some sort of interaction with, or some sort of like, I don't know, I think it makes it easier for the conversation to happen once in a while. And you know, we met a couple years ago, I think at a Gotham Go. And I really wanted to say that one of the things I think is really cool is that, you know, we talked about doing this and a couple days ago, and you said, you got to understand, I don't come from traditional on-call like op stuff. And I thought that was actually really cool to talk about, because you mentioned something that we'll get into having to do with a complete environment that you took down, which, mm-hmm. to be honest with you, I don't think you've been anywhere until you've taken down an environment at least once. Because then you
I think then you've been really like pre-disaster. And I know that story of, you know, someone takes down the environment and then the boss comes in and, you know, the guy says, please don't fire me, but I'd understand it. And the boss goes, fire you? I just spent, you know, $2 million training you. You know, mm-hmm. now you really get it.
Yeah. It's always interesting. Like I always like to mention about how I took down DigitalOcean real early, like when I started working there. And what we found out more than anything was just the poor hierarchy of permissions. And we also found out like some things were named like duplicate, and it really sucked that we found out the wrong way. But I guess those early times taking stuff down can teach people a whole lot.
Yep. Absolutely.
So Dan, I want to talk to you a little bit about your start in technology, because that's the way I like to kind of get this podcast started. So tell me, you had kind of like a traditional introduction into tech, is that right?
I'd actually say non-traditional, but in the overprivileged way. I
Okay.
grew up and my dad worked at Bell Labs, and so when I was sick from school and my dad was busy, Brian Kernahan was someone who'd come and pick me up from school. And so I think I ended up going to school and studying CS. And so in that way, very traditional, but just kind of growing up talking about quicksort over dinner, I think is non-traditional, but in the more privileged way, which I want to, acknowledge and figure out how to help make it that people don't need, that, or even just, going to school for CS to get into the industry, because this is a great kind of job. It's creating a lot of societal wealth, and I want everyone to be able to benefit from it.
Gotcha. So you came from, you went into Stanford after school, after, general education. You went over and you got your English degree. What kind of led you from going from, like, say, an English degree to moving into technology?
Spending high school and younger talking about quicksort growing up, I found that when I got to school, like CS classes, they gave me more nouns, but my brain kind of was already thinking that way. And I really like education is supposed to like teach you how to think in a new way. And so going in and taking English classes, I really had to like expand it and ask different questions and have different kinds of conversations. And that was really, I thought, more kind of mind-bending than, going in and doing some interesting, CS group project. But that was really was more useful in terms of growing as a person.
Gotcha. That's interesting. I found that people who find ways out of their comfort zone and start doing things to help them grow a little, I found to be people that tend to be really successful in technology, because they come to recognize that there are differences in people, in society, and getting different views on things, I really think helps. Interestingly enough, like, I dropped out of school after, like, my first year and a half. But one of the things that I actually did that I went back is I took another English class, maybe, after I've been in working maybe like 10 years. And I did that because I felt that I needed to be able to express myself better. Whether it's written communication to customers or writing that email to another coworker, because I started realizing that what technology gives you is a lot of great skills to build and create, but not necessarily always does it come along with the ability to communicate. And so I've really learned that doing something as simple as taking an English class helped me improve my education around just communicating with others.
Totally. I think that's really important, strunk and white, and just how do you emphasize for, being understood in ways that will help things move forward instead of just proving that you're quote unquote right is a good way to think about it.
Absolutely. So then after school, you go over and you spend time at Google for a while. Like, were you originally interning there, or did you go full time right after school?
I started as an intern in 2004, and I came in, and my intern project was, hey, the nightly build for all of Google is now taking more than 24 hours, so it's not really nightly anymore. How can we take that and distribute it across a bunch of computers using not it, there wasn't even Borg, which was Google's internal, system eventually that kind of inspired Kubernetes, but a system before that. distributing it and getting it so that now you could run all the builds and tests in the code base in 40 minutes instead of more than 24 hours, getting better feedback. And so I ended up then, that was 2004, that fall, joining as a full employee and ending up being the first person at Google who was full-time on developer tooling and experience. Up till then, it had all been what were known as intergrouplets. Instead of the group that you were assigned to, it was kind of volunteers from across the org and some of just the best and smartest people working on tooling to actually saying, hey, no, this is big enough and fundamental enough that we actually need a group that works on not any one product that users see, but the internal developer experience.
So did you see kind of like the creation and development of Go while you were there, or was that not really around the products that you were working with?
Oh, that came later. I guess that was more like 2009, and I certainly knew them. But even then, I think that was, you know, more so fundamental versus, hey, what's the build tool? So now at the time it was called Blaze, and now it's open source, Bazel. That the internal source code management, which was based on Perforce, that's been talked about a bunch of an article, and I think the communications of the ACM called Why Google Stores, you know, its entire repo, its billions of lines of source code in a single repo, those kinds of tooling.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I was just curious, like, that was the interesting part I found about the time you were at Google. It was a big time of, like, revolutionary change at what they were doing there. And that the practices and procedures that they started kind of utilizing became more and more part of general technology, as opposed to this is just the way Google builds this. And that's why I was curious if you'd seen Go kind of come out of that shop at the time. I was curious if it was a product of needing a better way to compile things faster or better. I was always curious if that was really the driver behind Go at that time.
Yeah. I think seeing, hey, we need these systems to make C++ builds manageable. And you know, one of Go's huge advantages is compile time. And a lot of that is, totally driven by this point. I think now you see all the debates. I know there are like parody Twitter accounts about the idea of a monorepo. And, you know, I'm sure other companies kind of did it, but I think Google really popularized it, or just, you know, the eventual exodus of Googlers to other companies is where you would hear somewhat annoyingly, well, at Google, and one of the things that was done at Google was having a monorepo where all of the code for some huge percentage of the company was in one repo. And
I can imagine tests and everything, like you said, for at one point just took a while, and it just took people like yourself to make it, and other teams obviously, to make things run faster, quicker, compile better, test quicker, whatever it is. It's just, more than anything, it's just amazing to me how that much innovation came out of that shop based on the fact that you had such a huge spread of systems across the world. So to be able to do deployments quickly, to be able to do updates quickly, all that stuff, it's just amazing how much was built out of your shop in that particular time. So you spent 11, almost 12 years at Google, right?
Yeah.
And then make a decision. You go to Twitter for almost 2 years. And what were you working on at Twitter?
Oh, also internal developer tools. I kind of have a bee in my bonnet about these. I think they're really a way that, you can really drive a lot of productivity. And I think we just, you know, there's that XKCD about, like, you know, my code's compiling being the number one excuse for programmers popping off. And I think it's still true. And you know, the more that we can show developers, you know, the piece of information that's going to move them forward, the more productive, and I don't know, that sounds really business-centric, I'd say, like, the more rewarding an experience it can be, the more that you can stay in flow and really get what you care about done better and, more elegantly.
Absolutely, and that's kind of what I believe you're doing at Windmill now, like full time, is you're looking to build developer tooling to make life easier for teams to build. Because some of the things we've talked about, you know, you're building collaborative real time tools and stuff like that, I think is really interesting. But now it's time to take a little trip, a little back further in the past. And that trip to the past requires me to tell some rules. That's the rules of the podcast. It's the way I do things. People who listen, you may already be familiar with the rules, but let's go over them. Rule number one, do not incriminate yourself. Why? Because nobody wants to get in any trouble, but I think maybe after this time, you're fine. Two, we don't incriminate others. And the big reason we don't do that is because all of our retrospectives are blameless. That's how we look at DevOps and SRE, blamelessness. And when I say retrospective, the third rule is to help us learn. This podcast is one giant retrospective. Everyone I talk to gives us a look back at something that they've done. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a time you were on call, but you certainly showed the value of on call in this particular incident. So I'd like you to give us a quick story about how you took something down, kind of important.
Yeah. So at the time I was working on a tool that was a predecessor to Blaze. So how Googlers did their development. And at the time it was actually a Python script that was just checked into the repo. And so when you'd come in the morning, you'd, you know, sync your code, get the new copy, and it would have, you'd just be running it essentially as a shell script from there. And there was like a make file that was checked in, and I was working on an improvement, and someone suggested a refactor, and I made the refactor and managed to forget to then, this was Python, so import the library, and that that then the program would die with an import error pretty early in its execution, which meant that anyone who pulled that code would go to build, and it would get an error pretty early in the life. And and so got reports of this on, you know, email and IM pretty quickly, made a quick change, and because at the time there was not CI that would like gate the change, got the change in. So then it was interesting, right? Kind of the firefighting was telling people, yeah, that's fixed in at head. So just think and it will be fixed, but it still took most of the rest of the day to actually get, you know, everyone, you know, that people would mainly, you know, see a link or something and go sync backwards and tell them, yeah, it's known broken there. And so the result was, yeah, that's not a good experience. Let's, you know, be way more careful about checking in changes to that script. It wasn't too long until we then started actually distributing copies of it as like a binary instead of just as a script. But definitely meant that there was like a period of 40 minutes of the source control history where trying to build would just get an error in the first, you know, few dozens of milliseconds of execution.
So this is across the entire Google development environment?
Yeah. Any of the, yeah, exactly.
So how many developers at that time would you attempt to even try to predict were impacted?
Yeah, I think that was, I want to say like summer of 2004, 2005. So a couple thousand. I don't think everyone synced. I don't think. But yeah, that's the order of magnitude. More than 500, less than 5,000.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's important to recognize the fact that when we talk about especially early computing environments, there would be less isolation and just tons and tons of people all using them at the same time. I think like a lot to pre-Docker days and why we looked at Docker isolation as a way to do environments. It's terrifying to think that, because I remember someone saying to me, well, make sure you roll a dev environment and then make sure you roll a staging environment. And then after that, then we roll a prod environment. And I would think about the fact that we would spend so much time and the biggest issues we would have sometimes is that someone wouldn't point the config properly and you would try to do something on a dev environment. You end up doing it in prod. No one would notice it until the alerting finally came around. And so here's the question I have for you. When did people start noticing that things weren't working correctly? Was it just an automatic? I don't know if SRE was in practice.
This was not even in any kind of data center. This was just on your workstation when you went to run a unit test or do.
So this is beyond distributed environment. This is just running local tests, correct?
Yeah.
And it broke it for everyone at Google?
Yeah.
Wow. So I guess, yeah, the spread and impact sometimes can be just based on what your code base changes are. And that is freaking terrifying.
Yeah. And you know, it's something interesting, right? Where like you fix a bug, but then like the bug is still, you know, in the historical source code because it's immutable. And so you have people, you know, you can say, hey, you just have to sync to get the change. But, you know, in this case, it was just nothing worked at all. But you can imagine that if like you had something in there where, you know, when every time you ran a unit test, like uploaded too much data based on what was in your source control tree, that, you know, you're having to like kind of run around and tell people, hey, you need to sync, because until you sync, you're like being a bad actor, you know, with respect to uploading data or whatever it is, right? Like you end up in situations where each developer's laptop, right, is controlled just by that developer, which means you can end up with kind of a distributed denial of service that just fixing the config, you know, doesn't take, because it's actually, you have to wait for each developer to make that update.
Yeah. One of the cool things that I got to see when I was at BuzzFeed was when the team there decided it was time to finally kind of organize the developer tools and to build like ready to go environments based on Docker and abstracting a little bit away from the Git code base and having less and less touch master until it was absolutely necessary. And I think that was one of the things that I've learned a lot about in the last 10 years is since we moved from SVN to Git and making things a lot easier to test because of the fact that we've got tools like Docker that we can execute things, or, you know, RSpec for those weirdos like me who write Ruby, and the fact that we've built all these things to help us get it right the first time, I think is the biggest change that I've seen over the 10 years, is create more organization, create more communication. So when something gets committed, that we have, you know, information in GitHub with commit messages and some sort of understanding of where the problem starts and finishes. So I think that's a great part about where we are right now for developers, and then the ops teams that support them, is that we like I said, I mentioned earlier when we were talking, like people are, I think, are getting better at communicating. They're hearing the screams, I think, that came from the DevOps movement of, you have to talk to one another. You have to let each other know. And if it comes to making changes to like development environments, like we need to check them all in. We need to talk about why this is happening and how it's going to impact the other developer on the other side of the planet. And so I think that's a really interesting part about how we've changed to think more about the person on the other side of the planet and what their impact is going to be overall, and how things you do and things I do change a code base, and it needs to be understood.
Yeah, well, I think the relationship between a code base and, you know, the system that it implies, which is both, you know, hey, here's these, you know, binaries or deployments or however I want to think about it running in data centers, but also like, hey, part of what the distributed system is actually the people who are doing development of any kind that, mm-hmm. yeah, nowadays tends to be geographically distributed or time zone distributed. Like, that's another living, breathing piece of the system.
Absolutely. So if someone right now is a developer, a software developer, mm-hmm. and they're working with on-call teams and they're working with these types of complex environments, what as a developer would you give other developers advice about when it comes to working with on-call resources and being part of it? They may not be on call, but you know, they need to be available to those resources. What kind of advice would you have for them?
Well, I mean, I think thinking of what kind of support and reliability do you want for your developer experience? Because mm-hmm. At the time at Google, we had like priorities of bugs. So like, you know, P1 was like money, you know, is being lost, or, you know, we're giving out, you know, we're leaking data, right? That was like the highest. But then some people were making the point of like, hey, if your tests are broken, you can't even, you know if the fix that you might want to that is reasonable. And so a broken test should be like a P0. And then like, if you have a broken build, you can't even know if the test is working. So that's like P-1. And if you're, you know, and like you can kind of just keep coming up with scenarios that go kind of higher and higher up into the negatives. And so like, I think something to think about is like, hey, your developer experience team, like, does it need to be on call? And, you know, it might not need to be on call in the same way, right? But like, I don't know, I've seen companies have a Slack support channel, right? Or something. But what happens when you come in the morning and like, sure, maybe you can like kubectl or whatever way you talk to your cluster, but if you're having a problem actually, you know, building the binary that could fix some problem, you know, you can kind of see what's wrong. But if you need to deploy a code fix and the developer experience is broken, what happens then? And so mm-hmm. I say, not like, here's what I'd suggest you adopt, but just like, think about that. And like, you know, maybe the answer is, yeah, it is kind of business hour. And if it's anything more, you know, if it's some kind of catastrophe, then we'll have to like go, you know, start calling people until we can find the right person. And it's not a formalized on call, but like, you know, that's a form of on call. That's a choice that you might be making implicitly. And it's worth at least, you know, knowing that.
Absolutely. So tell me a little bit about what you're doing with Tilt and Windmill.
Yeah.
About that. I know, but I want the rest of the listeners to know a little bit more about what you're up to lately.
Yeah, yeah. So thanks. I mentioned that at Google, the like benefit of the mono repo was that you could build anything, right? It's the same tooling to build Gmail as it is to build search. And like that's conceptually pretty cool, especially in light of like Google's idea of 20% time. Hey, I have some idea for a product. You know, I think that Gmail should behave differently. I can get going with it with the same tool. Great. That sounds really amazing. And it is in lots of ways. But what I realize now is that if you actually tried to do that, yeah, you could build the Gmail binary using Blaze or Bazel. But if you actually want to like run Gmail, you actually want to like see what it's like, it's not just running one binary. It's running this back end and that storage service and this front end. And so you wouldn't be able to use one tool anymore. You'd have to go see some wiki page or some shell script that would, you know, end up starting each binary with different command line flags that were in different terminal windows. And you'd have to kind of keep the binaries up to date when, as you made changes to one service or another. Mm-hmm. And so we're making Tilt, which is trying to make it that when you come in the morning on a distributed system or microservices, you just run Tilt up, and then you have that instance of your whole app running tied to your hard drive, so that it's as simple as really, again, running one tool. You just run Tilt up, you make changes, and your whole distributed system stays up to date.
Makes sense to me. It sounds really useful. Well, how can people get in touch with you, Dan, if they need to get more information about this or what you're doing with Tilt?
Yeah. I'm on Twitter at dbentley. Tilt's at tilt.dev. I'm Dan at tilt.dev. We're in the Kubernetes. Tilt's really built for systems with Kubernetes. If you use Kubernetes for production, you need Tilt for dev. So in that Kubernetes Slack, there's a Tilt channel. We're hanging out in there. And yell my name real loud and maybe in hearing range. Yeah.
It feels like that's what I did on Twitter to get you on this episode. So I know it works. You see, everybody, if you follow his system of yell his name, he will hear you. Dan, thank you so much for giving me some of your time today. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, it was great to chat. Cheers.
And like Dan said, if you want to check out what he's doing, I believe it's tilt.dev, windmill.engineering, I believe, is the other URL.
Yeah, it now redirects. Branding is tough, especially for startups. So like Windmill's kind of the company, but the tool's Tilt, like tilting at windmills. Like I said, I really have a bee in my bonnet about dev tools.
Gotcha. Well, thank you so much. And we'll be right back. We'll wrap everything up. And we'll hopefully see you soon at another really great event here in New York City. So catch you soon, Dan. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
That's it for this week. Appreciate your time and all the things you had to offer for us, Dan. I really thank you for being part of this podcast. And if you would like to be on the podcast, really easy. Send an email to oncallnightmares@gmail.com. Reach out on Twitter @oncallnightmare. Or more than anything, just keep listening to the podcast, because without you listening to it, there's no reason for me to keep doing it. So I'll catch you next time when I have another conversation with a technologist who spent time on call. See you then.